Roach Brown is the host of Crossroads, which airs Tuesdays from 10 to 11 a.m. Each episode brings vital information to you about the state of our country's prison systems. Roach's mission is to share criminal justice issues with an emphasis on the incarcerated and the newly released, the returning citizens. Listen Tuesdays from 10 to 11 a.m. In case you missed the show, stream it later at WPFWFM.org on our archive, or subscribe to Crossroads on iTunes and Google Play Music. On your station for jazz and justice, WPFW Washington.
Peace, y'all. This is Rod Stars.
This is G1. Together, we Rebel Diaz.
And when we out here in D.C., the DMV, we bump WPFW.
Washington.
Every Tuesday, 9 to 10 a.m., Voices with Vision. You heard?
Understand. We've been trying to move this struggle from a lower to a higher level.
This is Voices with Vision, bringing you news and analysis.
It's about cutting-edge social justice issues by mixing various voices and ideas
with information, cultural expressions, and commentary.
Voices with Vision airs every Tuesday on your jazz and justice station, WPFW.
Good morning. It's the Tuesday, April 16th, 2024 edition of Voices with Vision. As usual, we have a very nice show for you. I'm Netfer Freeman, one of your co-hosts, coming to you live and direct in the virtual studio with your other co-host, Brother Craig. What's good, Brother Craig?
Hey, good morning, Netfer, and good morning to all our listeners and podcast subscribers. Today's show, Netfer interviews filmmaker Juan Mejia Botero, whose film, Igualada, is one of the films in this year's Film Fest DC. Igualada is a film that shows the rise of Colombia's first black vice president, Francia Marquez, from her amazing trajectory from a very underprivileged life.
Yes, and then we speak with attorney and author of Raw Law and Urban Guide to Criminal Justice, Mohamed Bashir, about the stealth fascism sweeping the U.S. in the form of crackdowns on crime. Before we get into all of that, Mumia Abu-Jamal tells us what a difference half a dozen makes. For all our freedom fighters, the U.S. held political prisoners languishing behind prison walls. What's the call?
Freedom all.
Difference a half dozen makes. The war against Gaza has entered now its sixth month, and no end is in sight. Over 33,000 souls, men, women, and children, are dead. Thousands of housing units have been destroyed, and millions of Palestinians are facing imminent famine and utter starvation. Notice I said the war against Gaza instead of war against Hamas, an Islamist resistance organization. Why did I say this? Because the vast majority of the dead are non-combatants. Thousands were children? Are we to believe they were Hamas babies? The hatred Israelis feel towards Arabs in general and Palestinians in particular are beyond the pale. But this conflict is more than racist and more than merely political. It is both existential and territorial. It is a settler colonial conflict that covets the land of Palestinians. It could care less for the people. Doesn't that explain the naked carnage of the war? Doesn't that explain the average of 5,000 deaths per month? One need look no further than the IDF's killing of three shirtless Jewish hostages speaking Hebrew. As the saying goes, shoot first, ask questions later. If you're in the territory, you're a target. And then the killing of seven World Central Kitchen helpers happens, and liberals go bonkers. Israel gets raps on its knuckles. Bad dog, bad dog. Really? Really? Some 33,000 Palestinians get slaughtered, and the virtual silence is deafening. Dr. Franz Fanon, in his classic work, The Wretched of the Earth, said that colonial conflicts are between two different species. Colonizers are deemed human. The colonized are less than human. For being unfree, they are non-human, because only humans are free. Liberals call for a ceasefire. Why not go to the core of things by demanding an end to occupation? Don't Palestinians deserve freedom? Don't Palestinians deserve a right to exist? Don't Palestinians deserve statehood? Or are these things only for Israelis? Perhaps I'm not being fair. Perhaps. But then I think of the words of an Israeli diplomat, the ambassador who was discussing peace with Palestine, Danny Danon, Israel's UN ambassador. In an op-ed piece for the June 24th, 2019 edition of the New York Times, wrote that Palestinians need only do two things to establish peace. A, commit, his words, national suicide. And B, surrender. Think of that. A French imperial colonial couldn't have said it better. The U.S. is not a fair nor impartial arbiter. It is deeply biased in arms apartheid Israel with weapons, not of defense, but of offense. The IDF stands for the Israeli Death Force. So let us begin with a call. Cease the occupation. With love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
Definitivamente Francia Márquez es un fenómeno. Todo el mundo está hablando de Francia Márquez.
Somos descendientes de hombres y mujeres libres que fueron esclavizados.
A mí me han dicho que soy una igualada. Pues sí, soy igualada, ¿y qué?
As part of the upcoming Film Fest DC that's happening, one of the films in that Film Fest, which begins this weekend, is the film Igualada. At the age of 40, Francia Márquez was elected Colombia's first black vice president, in addition to presenting her amazing trajectory from single mother from an impoverished rural area, former domestic worker and relentless defender of land rights and the environment. The filmmakers of Igualada had privileged access to her unconventional electoral campaign. This film definitely captures the tension such an audacious endeavor could produce. And with me to talk about this film is the director of the film, Igualada, is Juan Mejia. Juan, welcome to Voices with Vision.
Thank you. Thank you, Netfa. It's a pleasure to be here.
One of the things that this reminds me of, I don't know if you're familiar with it, is and this is a stretch, but I'm going to mention it. There's a film that was able to capture the coup that tried to depose the elected president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, and they happened to capture that while they were on the ground. Yeah, and the way that I don't know if you talk about the opportunity to come in there. Obviously, this is a different situation. An election is planned and people know what's coming up and all that. Let's talk about the genesis of Igualada.
Yeah, you know, it's a long way coming, to be honest. Yeah, I met Francia Márquez back in 2006. She was part of the Proceso de Comunidades Negras, one of the kind of most important, black organizations in Colombia, political and activist organizations. And we were, you know,
That's for the people who don't speak Spanish, like the Black Communities Process or something.
Exactly. Yeah. Black Communities Process. They're a big, you know, rights and land rights organization, black organization. And that's where Francia got a lot of her, kind of her initial political education, to call it that. And she was at the time also one of the young leaders fighting against mining concessions in her territory of La Toma, which threatened to displace her entire community. And she was one of the folks leading the fight for the community to remain in the territories. At the time, I was working on a series of short films about forced displacement. So obviously, there was a connection there, and that's how we met. Then in between 2009 and 2011, I worked on two films, short films, about La Toma and their struggle to remain in their territory. And obviously Francia was one of the protagonists since she was one of the young people leading that fight. So we became close back then. And then in 2020, when she had the crazy and incredible idea to run for president of Colombia, to move from how she says it, from resistance to power, she called me and she told me she was doing this, she was gonna run. And, you know, once I got over the shock of the news, I told her, you know, this is something that's going to be, no matter how it turns out, it will be historic and we should document it. Initially, she didn't want to do that. You know, Francia doesn't really like that protagonism, that level of protagonism. But then she said, and I remember this very well, she said, they don't make films about communities like mine or about women like me. And she said, okay, let's do it. And in August of 2020, we started the shoot.
Now, talk about the content of the film, how it's documenting it. I mean, Francia Márquez, she's the first Black woman, and she's also, what we're seeing also in Latin America, is a rise of people who don't come from privileged background. Of course, that's common if you're Black anyway, you're not the yeah. likelihood of it. But then also, but there's this uniqueness there. Let's talk yes. about that. And the title. The title Igualada and, you know, what that yeah. means. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's all connected, you know, because like you say, right, and Colombia, as most of Latin America, I'll venture to say, is, you know, still deeply racist, elitist and misogynist. And we haven't managed to overcome a lot of those colonialist vestiges. And to be born a woman, rural, black, and poor, is, you know, is usually, I would say, usually kind of defines an expected sort of destiny. For somebody to be born in that context, in Colombia, and to have led the types of fights that Francia has, and to then now be sitting in the vice presidency of the country, is almost unimaginable. I mean, I am myself still, you know, shocked by the idea that this is the reality, you know, that the multiple glass ceilings, steel ceilings, concrete ceilings that Francia had to break to get to where she's at is nothing short than incredible. And the title of the film, Igualada, comes from a very derogatory insult. You know, the word Igualada in Colombia is used to demean and insult people who believe they deserve rights and privileges that society is telling you you don't deserve, right? To occupy places that society says are not meant for you to occupy, right? So it does come from the palabra igual, you know, equality, yeah. Equal, right? And when Francia announced in 2020 that she was going to run, you know,
Twitter... Hold on. Can we just say, though, explicit, so the closest translation, right, is uppity nobody? Is that right?
I would say similar to the way that uppity was used, let's say, during the civil rights movement and during the 50s and 60s to talk about black people that were defying mm-hmm. the status quo, right? So in the way that that word was used, uppity, and at that time, I think it has a similarity to the way that igualada is used in Colombia, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which is saying you're trying to present yourself bigger than you are, right? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, saying you deserve things that we're saying you don't deserve, right? This is not mm-hmm. your place. You're out of place. Mm-hmm. So I think uppity in that context works as the closest translation.
Yeah, and I didn't mean to cut you off, but I just wanted to make sure.
Yeah. And then, so Francia announced she was going to run publicly through a tweet, right? So then Twitter obviously exploded, and I was paying very close attention to the news and the way that folks were reacting. And, you know, immediately there were a lot of comments, obviously some in support of Francia, but many against, right? Or, you know, questioning her decision. And there was one that came right away, very early on in those reactions, that really caught my attention. And it said, esa negra, ¿quién se cree que es? Mucha igualada, right? Which would mean, you know, who does that black woman think she is, you know? And you know, and then mucha igualada, you know? And that just, to me, when I read that, I was like, man, that encapsulates so well, you know, kind of one of the fights that Francia has had to wage mm-hmm. all the time, right? This idea that she believes they, you know, her people or all Colombian people deserve to live in the conditions that only a privileged few do, right? And that's been a lot of her struggle. So I thought, man, that's the perfect title. Iguala is the perfect title. I'll confess, I was a little nervous to tell Francia, because it is a very demeaning word. It is very derogatory. Mm-hmm. But when I brought it up with her, you know, she was all for it. It was not the first time she'd heard that insult kind of hurled at her by any means. So she was for it. And not only that, she kind of adopted the word, and her campaign adopted that word and mm-hmm. subverted it, you know, and kind of gave it a new meaning. You know, one became kind of a term of empowerment for the campaign and for the broader movement that then came to support Francia. So you had her use the word igualada in speeches throughout the campaign, and folks around the movement referring to themselves as igualadas, you know, like it became kind of a word of empowerment, which I thought was rather beautiful. Yeah.
So you actually your place there is a little bit more than a filmmaker. You can inspire some movement type stuff here.
Yeah. I think the title really, really resonated. And I think it does, if you think about the meaning of the word, you know, and its origin, really.
And people embraced it, and understanding it being signifying also the attitude of those who use it. In other words, their mentality, exactly. and what we had to push back against. And so if you can also talk about that, the movement, one stuff that the Francia Marquez, Vice President Francia Marquez, I should say, has to deal with, and the movement in general, and then how the slogan, the slogan, Soy Porque Somos, plays into this.
Soy Porque Somos, which comes from the word Ubuntu, right? Became, one of the driving sort of principles of the movement, right? And this is, again, Francia doesn't like that personal protagonism. That's one of the issues she herself has with the film, that she feels is too centered around her. And she wants always for it to be understood that her struggle didn't begin with her. It began long before her, and that she stands on the shoulders of her ancestors, and that fight will continue even when she's gone. And that's something that she, is very, very clear about. So Soy Porque Somos, I am because we are, became sort of a leading slogan and chant and kind of principle of the movement.
No ver el territorio solo como una fuente de riqueza, sino como una fuente de vida.
Todo aquel que se pille desobedeciendo nuestras órdenes ya cayó.
Estamos enfrentando a unos monstruos como son las empresas transnacionales.
Hay una política de muerte que todos los días se impone sobre la vida de la gente.
Entonces esa impotencia fue lo que hizo decir, yo quiero ser presidente de este país.
I am because we are, right? It is a communal struggle. And I think it was also the way that this campaign was able to work, you know. Francia, you know, ran as a presidential candidate, as a black woman, who was born and educated far from where Colombian elites and politicians are usually educated and where they grow up. You know, she didn't go study in Princeton or Harvard or Georgetown. She didn't speak English. She didn't even speak in the same way that these elites usually speak. So for her, it was an uphill struggle all the way. But for the campaign in general, it was too, because this campaign was led mostly by young women and young people in general, ethnic communities, LGBTQI+ communities, who were committed wholeheartedly to this movement, but who didn't have the resources traditional political campaigns do, and they didn't honestly have the political experience either, right? So they had to really rely on each other, right? The movement had to rely on itself and on everyone around it for this campaign to be successful. And for Francia, again, to have gotten to where she got, to be sitting today as Colombia's first, black vice president, black woman vice president, it's a testament to that Soy Porque Somos, I am because we are, because it was truly the emergence of a, very powerful social movement of, young people, ethnic communities, diverse communities, women in general too, who kind of allowed themselves to be hopeful again. And that's nothing short of amazing in a country like Colombia, where the same people have been in power since the country's inception, right? Mm-hmm. Other Latin American countries, most of them have had progressive or leftist governments come in and out. Colombia has never had that. Colombia had never had a progressive country government until today. So, it is a pretty unbelievable accomplishment. And I think that's why the film is also so important, because this was truly a historic moment for Colombia, and one that deserves to be documented.
So, I know what you're describing here demonstrates what's in the film, but is there a way you can give more of an illustrating, describe or help people visualize a synopsis?
Yeah. So the film really is a film about, the struggles, the plight of Francia Marquez, in a way, from when she was kind of a political organizer, a community organizer, in her early 20s. All the way till she becomes Colombia's first vice president. But like she says, it wasn't a singular struggle, it's a collective struggle. So the film also tells the story of this social movement that starts to grow around Francia and that really pushes her campaign, you know, to where it got, right? To coming in an incredibly strong second place in primaries that nobody, you know, saw coming, and making Francia and the political movement Soy Porque Somos, you know, a political phenomenon, right? Like the day of the primaries, nobody talked about anything else because, you know, honestly, almost nobody could really believe it. And it really positioned her where, you know, where our current president, Gustavo Petro, had really very little choice but to go with her as his vice presidential candidate.
Mm-hmm. Now, we want to tell people that the showing of this film within the Film Fest DC, that it's only two showings, right? It's Wednesday, April 24th, and which you're going to actually be there in person to be one of the, from my understanding, in there in person, you and yes. your producer one. Yep. And then also showing again on Friday the 26th. I guess you may not be there, but there will be a speaker there. Jimenez Sanchez is the director of Andes of the Washington office on the Americas. Washington yep. office on Latin America, I'm sorry.
Yep.
And this is at the Landmark E Street Cinema. Everybody, people should know how to get there. Landmark E Street Cinema. It's been a minute since I've been there, but I'll be there and I'll get to meet you in person. That'll be great. People should go to the website to get their tickets in advance. Filmfestdc.org. Filmfestdc.org. This is going to be a really good film. I've seen the trailer. I haven't seen the film, but it's good. And you're hearing some of the audio from that trailer now. And anything else that you want us to know about, you know, the film anything?
Yeah, I think, you know, I like you said, I encourage folks to go see it. It's a beautiful film. It's a film about hope. I think it's a film that's very relevant for us in the United States today, because it's a film I think it's a film that gives us hope that there is a different type of politics that is possible. We don't have to settle for the same type of politics over and over again. And if it can happen in Colombia, if a different type of politics is possible in Colombia, you know, it's possible anywhere. So I think it's especially relevant for the U.S. today as we get close to elections. And, you know, I encourage folks to go watch it. It's a beautiful film.
Right. Can you maybe, if I know you got to go soon, but maybe can you say a little bit word about your producer and your filmmaking background? I think people might be interested to know that.
Yeah, we have, I'm Colombian, of course, but I've been living in New York now for 11 years. We have a production company called Human Pictures in New York City. We do only social justice, human rights focused work. You know, I've been making films, documentary films for, 25 years now. And, you know, I do a lot of work in Latin America and the Caribbean and in Colombia. Like I said, you'll see some beautiful archival footage of Francia as a community organizer back in 2009, 2010, which we shot back then with her. And it really, really enriches the film and gives you a very kind of rounded view of who Francia Márquez is, which not a lot of people have.
Mm-hmm. Well, excellent. I'm very much looking forward to this. And very nice to speak with you, brother. I'm you know, very honored to speak with you. Juan Mejia Botero is the director of the film Igualada, and it's going to be playing at the Landmark E Street Cinema as part of the Film Fest DC, April 24th, and also Friday, April 26th. And that's going to be around 6 o'clock. So go to the website, filmfestdc.org, get your tickets, and there's a lot of other good films in there, too. Hey, brother, thank you for being on Voices with Vision.
Netfa, thank you so much.
Ay, tengo mucho nervio. En serio. Ay, no, devolvámonos.
El pueblo manda, los dirigentes obedecen. Eso tiene que ser una realidad, no un discurso.
De allá yo vengo, del caserío. Vengo del río, que es madre y padre. Vengo de mamá partera, que parió junto a la tierra la libertad. La libertad.
listening to Voices with Vision, the show that's not for the politically faint of heart on your Jazz and Justice station. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
This is Brother Craig, and I'm in the virtual studio with NEPFA, and we have a guest for you today, a very special guest, and of course, no stranger really to Voices with Vision, Mohammed Bashir, who is a retired attorney with 30 years experience as an attorney, also the producer of the podcast, The Raw Law Project, which Thursdays 8 to 10 p.m. on hsrn.com. And he's also the author of April 4th, Lessons on Living and Dying. Welcome to Voices with Vision.
Brothers, thank you for having me. I appreciate the invitation.
All right. Welcome back.
Yeah, because we've had you on before, but I think it's been a little while. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to bring you on because there's a subject we've been talking about on the show over the last few weeks, and that is what's going on with these crime bills in D.C. and in Maryland. You know, as our listeners know, there's been
really all over the country now.
Yeah, and it's happening all over the country. But in D.C. and Maryland, we've talked about these crime bills that are consist of harsher penalties and expanded powers, and a lot of onerous provisions that are targeting our people, targeting our young people in particular. And creating new felonies and that type of thing. So we've spoken about that, and I'm sure it's all going to come out in our discussion, the dangers of bills like this and what we can face. But we wanted to bring you on really to talk about the historical context of these bills. These bills that are happening all around the country, it's not the first time we've seen things like this, where the through legislation, the police powers are being expanded. So can you talk to us and our listeners about the history of this type of legislation in the United States and what has been the consequences for African communities and poor communities around the country?
Yeah, sure. I think that one of the things that I hope that we will revisit as a community, especially in the Black and African community, is expert on this, Jawanja Kanjufu's Conquering the Conspiracy to Destroy Black Boys. He did a series of books back in the 80s, right? Psychologist out of Chicago. And he literally laid out what was going on about the conspiracy. And I think that we as a community have been fed the idea that if you say anybody time uses the word conspiracy, then you're not to give it the credibility that it deserves. But if you go back now in hindsight and look at what he was talking about, you can now begin to catch up to it and see exactly what happened. So let's start just with the 60s. What happened in the 60s was Black America shook the world up. It didn't just shake up America, it shook up the world. All right. It shook up the world in a sense that where the world began to bend toward understanding, at least hearing finally, the voice of Black America. And it wasn't a place you could go anywhere in the world where you didn't hear a Black American voice. You had Dr. King, you had Malcolm X, you had people moving internationally, you had James Baldwin going overseas, you had Josephine Baker, you had Black people being heard in the courts.
For the first time.
Brown versus Borders in 54. Brown versus Borders in 54, but in 51 is We Charge Genocide with William Patterson and Paul Robeson. Mm. And so that resonated around the world, all right? And so the government of the United States had to begin to adjust because they had postured themselves as land of the free, home of the brave, the arbiter of democracy around the world. We are the shining city on the hill, that kind of thing. And the world now is hearing William Patterson argued that they are destroying Black people, that they have historically been through every institution attacking Black people, murdering Black people. So We Charge Genocide is probably the biggest, most profound petition that has ever been put together by Black people in America because it resonated around the world. Now, it was shut down by America, But it got to France, it got to Africa, it got around the world at a time when Africa was coming into their neo-colonial, the elimination of colonialism. So it began to resonate. That's your historical context. Now keep that in mind, that's what's going on in Black America. That's the impact Black America is having. This is why you have your COINTELPRO. Your COINTELPRO says, we have to eliminate the rise of a Black Messiah who could unite whom? Didn't say Black people. Can unite militant Black people. The people who'd be willing to stand up against America. See, because they knew they had the handkerchief heads. They knew they had the educated elites. They knew that they had them in their corner. So now catapult from there to the assassination of Malcolm. Malcolm dies. As Malcolm dies, Frank Lucas rises. Frank Williams rises. So Malcolm dies in Harlem in 65. The rise of heroin in our community rises almost simultaneously. It's like you're replacing bad leadership with good leadership. Good leadership with bad leadership. So when the good leadership is gone, you wipe that out the scene, you offer the community the bad leadership. And it worked. And so that's why Richard Nixon is able to say, according to his Secretary of State, I think it was, John Ehrlichman, that we had two enemies. We had the Black community and the white community, who was the hippies. And we decided we were going to criminalize both. Was there a problem with drugs in America? No, there wasn't. But we knew that if we put them out there each and every night on the screen in front of the news, that we could criminalize both communities and then therefore control both communities. So now put that together with COINTELPRO and the government's stated purpose of declaring Black people the enemy. And that's when you begin to get your first series of crime bills. They were able to criminalize the community. They recognized they could criminalize the community and then therefore shut down so-called Black militancy. So even if they couldn't kill off all the Panthers and lock up all the Panthers, they knew that they could criminalize them. Is it a coincidence that right on the heels of Bunchy Carter dying in LA, the Panthers rising in LA, that crack hits our streets in LA? It's not a coincidence, it's orchestrated. Because if you Google right now, crack experiments, you'll find out that there was.
Just when we say web search, we don't say Google. Google's a company.
Oh, okay. We don't promote anybody. Okay, cool. But if you do a web search, you will find just that UCLA was experimenting. UCLA, Southern California, was experimenting on crack cocaine long before crack cocaine hit our streets. So they knew what the outcome would be. But they also had done experiments in the 60s and 70s with heroin before heroin hit our streets. So they knew what the impact would be on our community. And so that gave them the opportunity to criminalize the community. And they do it through their crime bills. Each bill that you go through, you will see an exact correlation between the rise of militancy, that is Black people be willing to stand up and battle against the government, because the only people who really want to see change in this culture are Black Americans. I don't care what anybody white tells you. And this is no disrespect to white people, but they have a vested interest in the status quo, keeping things the way they are. They just simply do. But the people who are benefiting from it are not going to try to change it. The people who are under the heels of it are going to be the ones who want to change it. So those are the people you have to control. That's what begins to happen. Nixon comes out with a crime bill. Reagan, on the heels of that, comes out with his omnibus crime bill. Keep that word omnibus in mind, because you just got one passed in D.C. saying the exact same phrasing. And it was to protect and to save the communities and things like that. So this is the context. Right on the heels of that, what happens? Crack hits our streets. Boom. All these enhanced penalties, three strikes, and you're gone forever. And it could be, you heard the crazy stories. A guy got arrested for a pizza and wound up doing life in prison. All those things were designed to make sure that they could control and corral the Black community. So they give you bad leadership in the terms of drug dealers and pimps and all that kind of stuff. They allow that vice into your community so that they could criminalize the community. And then the intent of it is not just to lock up what they consider to be the criminal, but now that opens the door to things like what? Stop frisk, right? Unreasonable searches and seizures. Stepping around the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, illegal searches and seizures. This is what all your stop frisk and all about. This all comes right out of that. and all designed to corral and control the community, the one community that they know has the impetus, even if we don't have the courage, to resist what's going on here in America.
And the potential, yeah.
That's right. Definitely the potential, because they saw the potential in the 60s and the 70s, the potential of what Black America could do as it impacted not just each and every city, each and every urban area, but each and every country around the world. Can go back and remember Malcolm X. You get Malcolm Katz quoting in Burkina Faso, quoting Malcolm X. I went to Hodge with a brother from Sweden, and he was telling me about the autobiography of Malcolm X, a Black man from Sweden. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? This is the impact that Black America was having. Now, if you just take it
and we don't want to forget the recent, well, I don't want to, maybe you were going there anyway, the most recent uprisings where they was, you know, in Minneapolis, they was burning the police station down.
Bruh, that's why you have what's going on in D.C. That's why you have what's going on in Baltimore. That's why you have in Cop City in Atlanta. That's why you have this rise of this anti-CRT, critical race theory. Anything that could potentially mobilize Black people the way they were mobilized in the 60s. See, what happened with George Floyd and that particular thing was kind of like just a spontaneous kind of thing. You know, there were some people in the background organizing and things like that, trying to get it going since Trayvon Martin. But their thought process was the same basic plot and plan and protest, the kind of Al Sharpton kind of protest. No disrespect to Mr. Sharpton, all right? But that's what they do. They tell you about, we're going to get police reform. We're going to get this, that, or the third. We're going to settle this case out of court, da, da, da. But we don't have an attack. And when the Panthers came along, they had an attack. They were creating their own food programs. They were creating their own Watch the Cops. They were creating their own attacks in the courts. They were creating their own feeding the kids and things like that, creating their own. That's the fear, that Black people may come together, separate from mentally and emotionally from white standards and begin to do their own thing. And those things will resonate in the white community. That's the reason why Nixon connected the white community with that. Those were those liberals who were funding money into the civil rights movement. So he had to shut them down too. Those are liberals in what he considered to be Hollywood who were, you know, putting out movies and things like that that gave Black people voice. So they had to shut that down too. Isn't it interesting that in this government, the FBI or the government has control over everything that comes out of Hollywood? They have to get approval. Even from movies like The Black Panther, they had to get approval. That's why, why you had that CIA guy be the hero and the government put him in there. But that's just the nature. That's the history. That's the backdrop. So if we look at any one of these crime bills, you go back right now to D.C. and you ask yourself, why is it that they would be willing to say that they can come into a neighborhood and have it declared a drug-free zone for 5 days? The only time you get to declare anything as on the street, having tried 1,000 of these cases, a high crime neighborhood, is because the police said it's a high crime neighborhood, not because they can clearly demonstrate that it's high crime. See, high crime for them means how many arrests do you make? So if you go back to 2014 and you look at the stop frisk trial that happened in New York State, where somebody actually challenged stop frisk statistics, what you found is that there were over 500,000 stops in New York City. There aren't 500,000 kids in New York City, but over a period of time, 500,000 stops, and 90%, 95% of the kids who were stopped had no contraband on them. But what it did was it literally criminalized a community mentally, intimidated a community mentally, all right? Had these kids on edge that whenever they walked out there, and in fact, the trial found that the person most likely to have contraband, that is guns, drugs, anything like that, was a white male. They found that in a courtroom, the judge had to rule on that decision. But she also ruled that by virtue of this particular tactic being used, Black people would not report crimes to the police because they didn't know whether they were going to wind up being the next, what's the brother's name, Chamberlain out of Eleanor Bumpers or Chamberlain from out of Long Island, wherever he was from, Westchester County, where the police come in your house and you wind up dead. So Black people stopped reporting crimes. Isn't it crazy that right on the heels of Freddie Gray, the government did an investigation a federal investigation and found out that Baltimore police were continuously violating the rights of the people, Freddie Gray, is 2017. I mean, come on, stop and frisk was back in David Dinkins' day, and, you know, moving all the way up. So all these times, think about it, under Obama, how many consent decrees do you have? 22 cities with consent decrees that say that the government or the police have violated the rights of the people by virtue of what they consider to be the law. And then 2008 comes around and you get a decision saying that they have something called qualified immunity, that they can, if they violate your rights and you don't have a case precedent to establish that they knew or should have known that they were violating your rights, then you can't sue the cop. All of that is part and parcel of the law. Now take any one of those things that I just gave you and look at the DC crime bill that just came out. What did they say? You jump a turnstile, they have a right to force you to give you the information. Where's mm-hmm. that in your Constitution? Where's that in the Constitution? There's nowhere in the world in the Constitution say you can force anybody to do anything. You have the right to remain silent according to the Fifth Amendment. If you give up that right, anything you say can be used against you. You can't force me to do anything. That's a violation of every aspect of the 1871 Civil Rights Act and the 1964 Civil Rights Act. But they put it in that particular bill. Why? That's a way of doing the exact same thing mentally and emotionally to the youth that they did with crack, that they did with criminalizing back as far as Reagan and Nixon. And heaven forbid we even start talking about Bill Clinton, you know, and Joe Biden, by the way. Joe Biden was the one who actually wrote that crime crap. But that's just the nature of it. See, it's a mental and emotional attack that appeases white folks and destroys the mentality of Black people. And it comes from what I always say in my show, the most important decision ever made by the Supreme Court in America is not Brown versus Board, it's not Plessy versus Ferguson, it is Dred Scott, because it outlines the mentality of white America. And I'm not talking about an individual white person. I'm talking about people who are educated under white supremacist systems.
And all of their flunkies.
And it outlines their mentality that a Black man has no right, that a white man is bound to respect, and that if you are Black or born of African descent, you cannot be a citizen of the United States. That's what they were saying, and that's exactly what they're attempting to say right now. And this is what all these crime bills are saying. What else do you have in that crime bill in D.C.?
There's a couple. There's one thing that if you steal, was it $1,000 worth of?
They wanted to lower the threshold to $500.
Yeah, right.
Lower it from $1,000 you had to have before you could be charged with a felony down to $500. Why? Again, because before below $1,000 meant it was a misdemeanor, so you could possibly go home. But what does the 13th Amendment say? They can institute slavery based on a felony conviction, right? That's what the 13th Amendment says. Slavery is abolished in these United States except upon the commission of a felony. So change a misdemeanor into a felony and you get your pound of flesh. And again, all you have to do is go back and look at the crime bills from before. What did they do before? When Clinton came along, they changed. It was simple possession with intent to distribute. They came up with his federal crime bill, opened the door for the states to offer 1,000 foot within a school, 500 foot within public housing, all those other bills that had enhanced penalties so that they could incarcerate more people or make sure people got felonies when possession was getting you diversion. Right? You had simple possession, you got a diversion. But if you got a possession with intent or a possession with intent with 500 feet, 500 foot meant mandatory prison. So then therefore, what came on the heels of that? What came on the heels of that? What came on the heels of that was the prison industrial complex and mass incarceration. So people were making money off of it. And so therefore, and also keeping the rise of militancy down in the community. Mm-hmm. The minute Black people led the revolt on George Floyd and it went international, that's when white America went crazy. They started taking terms like woke, which is something that Black people have been saying since, I don't know, Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, wake up everybody, no matter 75. Black people were asking you to wake up. Spike Lee said it in the movie. Come on, wake up. Right. You know, this is going on. But they took terms like that, like CRT, and turned them into a way of saying we have to control these people, and the best way to do it is by the law. I'll give you an example. You take DC, and well, I don't even want to deal with Baltimore because they're getting ready to build the biggest prison for juveniles in the East Coast. But they got no heat in their schools, you know, in the winter, but they're willing to build a facility like that. But dig this. The reason for this new crime bill in DC is supposed to be a rise in crime, but almost every state, including DC, is reporting that crime is down. That would, and what they want to do, hire more police. But crime is down when you didn't have police. How does that work, that you need more police now? The only way to get more police is to get back to the same standards of before, being able to stop people randomly, to be able to intimidate the community, and it always goes to the Black community. So for example, I got some statistics for you. Violent crime is down in DC. In case anybody tells you it's not, violent crime is down. Overall violent crime is down 10% from 2023 in 2024. And homicides were up in 2023, but they were down in 2022. So something happened between 2023, because now they're down in 2024 percentage-wise. You see what I'm saying? So and so they use that particular statistic, a crime went up, to be able to push this on to the community as a way of controlling the community. Robberies, they want to talk about carjacking. They're down now as compared to last year. Last year was your gentrified year. It's the year right out of George Floyd, et cetera. And that's what they were attempting to do. So if you screw the statistics up just a little bit, so you get them high and get people ready to go, because same thing that happened before, they're coming after the Black community, they're coming after the Black mind, because the Black mind is the one that is demanding change. And so in order to control that change, they are shutting that, they are doing everything they can in the law, as they did before, to shut down the next generation of young voices. And it's sad to see it coming, but having been through it, having tried cases in the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, the pattern is there for me. I see the history. I see the same players in the same players that are out there passing the laws now. And unfortunately, the next generation may fall victim if we're not ready to organize and get them to understand the history and the context of everything that's going on here right now. Mm-hmm.
Brother, thank you so much. That was a lot. We gotta have to bring you back on. Put you on the spot. You come back on, right?
Absolutely. Look, I really thank you guys for a great show. I listen to you every Tuesday.
Right, thank you. We've been talking to Mohammed Bashir, retired attorney, author of Raw Law, an Urban Guide to Criminal Justice, and the author of April 4th, Lessons on Living and Dying. He is the podcast producer of The Raw Law Project, Thursdays 8 to 10 p.m. on HSRN.com. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for today's show. Thank you for listening. Remember to tune in to Voice with Vision every Tuesday from 9 to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and follow and like Voices with Vision on Facebook.
You can follow me, Netfa, on X, used to be known as Twitter, Netfa Free, N-E-T-F-A, Free. Don't forget, you can also listen and subscribe to Voices with Vision as a podcast on iTunes or Player FM. Just search for Voices with Vision, WPFW. Keep it locked here for Crossroads with Rose Brennan and Kichi Taifa. Make an effort to stay politically educated, organized, and committed to the fight for the liberation of your people. Or fall back.
It goes FALLBACK. Fall back if you ain't trying to ride for your people. Fall back if you ain't trying to die for your people. FALLBACK. Fall back if you ain't trying to ride for your freedom. Fall back if you ain't trying to die for your freedom. LIBRBG, we live FREDIE. We lace music with code, just something to bring us closer. Kick true, the young Black youth like we're supposed to. No swine in our Rovers or Louis Vuitton holsters. We in the trench with young 50 cents and street soldiers. The ones they ain't lock up and send the foreign waters to fight for something they ain't got in their own borders. It's us, the free unit, they ain't holding us back. We just caught a soundtrack to this movie.
me, I just rap for that. Black on black and clap about that. State trooper shot, Miss Everly's boy in the back, Miss Rogers boy in the back. While we ain't firing back, the boys is gone and they ain't coming back. We gotta go back, San Cole for right and exact. It's the red, green, and the black, black, black. It go F-A-L-L-B-A-C-K. Fall back if you ain't trying to ride for your people. Fall back if you ain't trying to die for your people. Come on. F-A-L-L-B-A-C-K. Fall back if you ain't trying to ride for your freedom. Fall back.
Hi, this is Miyuki Williams, recently appointed interim general manager. I want to thank each and every one of you who supported WPFW during our recent relocation drive. You are the fuel that keeps us going. We appreciate your generosity and the collaboration of building a better world, one broadcast at a time. Please know we all love you madly.
ADASI, the African Diaspora Ancestral Commemoration Institute, will host a free DC Emancipation Day program entitled Black Liberation Struggles in Global Africa. Then and now, on Tuesday, April 16th, 2024, from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. at Enlightened Inc., 1205 Marion Barry Avenue Southeast, the program will commemorate the enslaved ancestors who crossed over the Old Navy Yard Bridge, the precursor to the 11th Street Bridge in Southeast, from enslavement in Maryland to freedom in the District of Columbia after the abolition of slavery in D.C. on April 16, 1862. It will feature esteemed historian C.R. Gibbs and many others. For information, please call 202-505-2896 or visit adasiancestors.org. That's A-D-A-C-I ancestors.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Education, art, health, music, politics, and all things community.
Yes!
Join me, Ambrose Lane Jr., as we uncover the issues of D.C. communities east of the river on To the East, Mondays at 5 p.m. right here on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW 89.3 FM.
The search process for WPFW's next general manager is underway. Successful management searches begin by having conversations with stakeholders to clarify and document expectations for future management. Therefore, WPFW's local station board is inviting all stakeholders to participate in our online survey. To complete the survey, please click the link on WPFW's website. Because we need your input, the deadline for the survey has been extended to Friday, April 12, 2024. Thank you.
I testify.
Sophie's Parlor is the original women's radio collective. Wednesdays from 3 to 5 p.m., the best music divas on radio at 89.3 FM and sophiesparlor.blogspot.com.
WPFW is looking for a new place to hang our hats and microphones. And we're betting that members of WPFW's In the Know listening community, folks like you, may know of spaces where we might make our new home. Have you walked past or know of a cool space that appears to be for lease? Hip us to it. Know of something that's not yet on the market? We're all ears. Your station for Jazz and Justice requires 2,200 square feet of space in Washington, D.C. or immediate environs. Metro accessible with nearby parking. We value your suggestions and observations as we embark on this vital mission. Email your tips to WPFW.com.